And good evening, I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. The state election campaigns have officially kicked off with 570 candidates contesting in the 245 state seats in the August 12th polls. Now, what does the candidate lineup tell us about the calculations and strategies going into the campaign period? What should we be looking out for? Joining us now to discuss this further, we have Mujibur Abdul Muiz, who is the political analyst at UiTM. He is a fellow as well at the research consultancy Ilham Center. Mujibur, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I appreciate your time. Can we begin our conversation with a broad overview as to what trends you've observed from the candidate lineup, the seat allocation following nomination day last Saturday? What was surprising and interesting to note for you?
Well, thank you, Melissa, for having me today. Well, it is very obvious that when the nomination day is open, there are several issues that raise up by the public, especially on the candidates lineup. The most surprisingly enough for me in this thing is how the Pakatan Harapan and Barisan Nasional managed to cooperate among themselves. Yes, there are several issues of the candidates. It is also happened to the Perikatan Nasional, but somehow with their marriage of convenience in terms of a very short period of time, it really surprised me. And when they managed to compromise among themselves in plotting on how the candidate should be. And most of the time, there are issues where the possibility of UMNO to boycott or not giving enough cooperation for Pakatan Harapan in certain seat have been raised up. And I see that this have been settled well enough among themselves. And I would like to see how this kind of cooperation may stand a test during the campaign period. And of course, what are the outcomes of this in the 12th of August when the election day is come. So overall, I think there is not much issue, except there will be a complaint that the numbers of women's representation is still low in this state election, although these issues have been raised up for several times, and it has been echoed since what happened in the last general election 15, in which the numbers of women representation are not improved well enough in this state election as well.
Yeah, that's it. That is a very big complaint that many have raised. I want to talk about some of the states that I think can be key battlegrounds. Let's begin with Kedah. Some regarded a swing state because among the three Perikatan Nasional held states, I think Kedah is where they might be the weakest. I was wondering whether you agree whether Kedah might be a state where Perikatan Nasional will grow their strength, or might the state swing in terms of the pendulum once again? We've seen Kedah state government change hands many times since 2008. What do you think about the current sentiment? Can we take what happened in GE15 as a given that might be repeated in the state elections?
Yeah, the fact that Kedah is a swing state is very obvious to all political analysts to see whether the swing is going to change again. Since we have seen this trend in the last two or three election on how dynamic Kedah in terms of changing the government. But somehow it is very different fields whatsoever in what was happened in the last elections. Since Kedah now lead by Perikatan Nasional now lead by a very popular and of course populist leader in Sanusi, as well as Perikatan Nasional as well, need to face, although the sentiment of Malay Islam movement is still there in Kedah. But the difference is they have to face a strong collaboration between Pakatan Harapan and Barisan Nasional. And of course, as a Malay state of Kedah, Barisan Nasional need to play a bigger role in this particular thing. And one thing is already done with this good cooperation and of course a compromise between Pakatan Harapan and PH. But somehow I did not see this thing might affected Perikatan Nasional well because it depends on two things. Number one, how Barisan Nasional may convince their grassroots to support Pakatan Harapan, especially in the seat where Pakatan Harapan contested, especially when we are talking about the majority Malay constituent. Yeah, because without the support of the UMNO grassroots, it is very difficult for them to be Sanusi. Yeah, because it is not only chase away the Malay voters, since it is very extreme to them. Yeah, especially I see this sentiment have growing among the let's say mature and old voters, but still. It is very difficult for this issue to be swallowed or to be processed by the youngsters, since the youngsters are really looking Sanusi as a hero figure, and this hero figure is something that lack to the middle class or the new voters, the new Malay voters that have been missing, and it is not seen in UMNO as well as Pakatan Harapan. So for this thing, I think the battleground to wrestle or to lure the voters of this young middle class Malay is very crucial to either Perikatan Nasional to retain Kedah or Pakatan Harapan and Barisan Nasional to regain Kedah from Perikatan Nasional.
Okay, just to come to ask you to elaborate on Sanusi, is he still an asset for Perikatan Nasional at this point in time, or has his popularity, he was such a popular figure within amongst Kedahans, has that popularity waned given the controversy and his comments?
Yeah, for me there are two perspectives on Sanusi as a figures. He was indeed an asset for the northern part of Kedah, especially when we are talking about Kedah itself and as well the northern part of Penang, yeah, especially where the Malay voters are the majority in this particular seat, especially when we are talking about Permatang Pau, Tasik Gelugo, Kepala Batas. This is where Sanusi have been seen as a powerful figure to lead the Malay, especially when they are coming with this continuously keeping on the momentum of Malay Islam sentiment. But somehow he become a liability to a state like Selangor, Negeri Sembilan, simply because of the harsh word and the undermining action of him when he seems not seem he is now on trial of what we have considered as a seditious to this particular action. And I have seen that this have been drive away the Malay voters, especially in Selangor, when they, for the early part of the election, seem to have the upper hand to the Pakatan Harapan Barisan Nasional, especially when we are talking about the critical 30 Malay seat, which is enough for Pakatan Perikatan Nasional to gain a simple majority and, of course, later on take over Selangor. So it depends on the perspective and the context of Sanusi, whether he is a hero figure or he is a liability to Perikatan Nasional. But somehow, if we are talking or we are specifically concentrating Sanusi to Kedah or the northern part of Penang, definitely he have the upper hand compared to others. In terms of what I see, that Barisan Nasional, especially UMNO, as well as Pakatan Harapan in Kedah, does not have any individual that may match his personality in terms of Malay constituency and Malay voters.
Okay, well, that's so interesting to to think about Sanusi's effect outside of Kedah, particularly in Selangor. Is Selangor going to be a state where you think might be at risk of changing hands? What are the key areas that you're looking at in terms of what might influence the outcome?
Well, out of 56 seats of constituency in Selangor, you need to wrestle around 29 in order to get a simple majority to establish a government in Selangor. And of course, definitely, when we are talking about the chances of Perikatan Nasional to gain Selangor, the critical seat will be the 34 Malay seat, in which if they manage to gain 29 out of it, definitely they are going to establish a government in Selangor. But somehow this is a very risky strategy for Perikatan Nasional. As simple as now it is the different battlefield whatsoever in the last general election. And one thing is, whatever thing happened in Kedah, when Perikatan Nasional have a very solid leaders in Sanusi, they does not have this thing in Selangor. Although implicitly Datuk Seri Azmin Ali is seen to be leading the Perikatan Nasional, but Perikatan Nasional does not mention in whatsoever that he is going to be, let's say, poster boy or the upcoming Menteri Besar for Selangor.
Azmin Ali is not comparable to Sanusi as he is. It's Sanusi in Kedah, not comparable. Azmin Ali in Selangor.
Well, if you look at the record in the last general election, he was heavily defeated by he once then protege in Amin, in Amiruddin. So I think that sentiment is still there among the Selangorians. And whether he can stand the challenge with Juwairia is now challenging him in his own backyard in Hulu Kelang. This definitely will be the very challenging. But somehow I did not see Perikatan Nasional Mayor have an easy chances to wrestle Selangor by banking on the strategy of winning the majority Malay seat. Which is going to, let's say, win a simple majority for wrestle Selangor from Pakatan Harapan.
Very quickly, we're running out of time. I just want to ask you, given your work with Ilham Center, I'm wondering, what is your sense of whether or not voters are already decided going into the state elections, and what might influence their decision in the next 2 weeks? What will you be watching out for in the campaign trail?
Yeah, in short, I think for the grassroots voters, they already decided, regardless of what happened between these 2 weeks time frame. But the most critical one will be the fan sitters, especially the Malay young fan sitters, which is still undecided, and they still can be influenced by any political party who has managed to win them and know how to win them, especially with this new approach and new medium of campaign, in which whoever managed to send the right message to them, they are going to win this segment of votes in the upcoming state election. I think so far it is still undecided, but within this 2 weeks, anything can happen, Melissa.
Anything can happen. Mujibu, thank you so much for speaking with me on the show today. Political analyst Mujibu Abdulmu is from UITM. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Following nomination day last Saturday, we now have 570 candidates contesting for the 245 state seats in the August 12th polls. Now, out of that 570 candidates, a meager 71 are women. Now, that's 12.5%, meaning only one woman for every seven male candidates. That's nowhere near the 30% target that many parties have imposed on themselves. Joining me now, I have Arina Najwa Ahmad Syed, who is a director at the political risk consultancy Bauer Group Asia. Arina, thank you for being on the show today. I'm hoping you can begin by giving us an overview of the landscape as it stands. Should we name and shame the parties that have failed to meet even the 30% target, let alone achieving gender parity in their candidate lineup?
Yeah, thanks so much, Melissa, for having me. Well, I think, interestingly, the party that actually managed to hit the target or even supersede that is probably MUDA. They fielded 10 candidates out of 19. 10 of them are female. The youngest candidate in the entire election is also female, Melanie Ting. She's 23 years old. So they've got about a 53%, female candidates out of the entire candidacy. If we're looking at the others, PH has about 18%, 26 candidates out of 138. BN has about 12, that's out of 12 out of 108, so that's about 11%. PN has 19 out of 200 and maybe 245 seats, so that's about 7%. So I think they're the lowest, 7 to 8%, that's the lowest that we have throughout. So I think it is still quite abysmal in terms of the showings, because these do not mean winners, right? So it's going to be 12%, much less than that. It's going to be quite worrying. I think if we're looking at trying to achieve gender parity in politics, it's still a long way to go.
Okay. Did you notice any trends in how and where the candidates were fielded? I mean, are they being placed in seats that are considered less winnable? Are they being fielded against other women? Are there displacement of existing women? Because it struck me when you said 12% doesn't necessarily mean 12% is going to win and 12% representation in state legislation. What trends are you noticing, Arina?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think because we've seen a lot more candidates this time around. So I wouldn't say necessarily that they've been displaced. There are quite a few as well that are also incumbents coming back into their own seats. So I think it's a fairly mixed bag. But I do see at least a larger interest in terms of younger women entering into politics. So I think that's definitely a trend that I'm quite excited about. I hope, and I think there's been, some interesting feedback, right? Like, I think with women and with gender, with women and with age, gender and age, I think that's a double whammy, especially for some of these candidates, because they're young. What do you know? And then even more so, you're a woman. That means, I think, there's a stronger sense of bullying, or additional comments. I think people tend to use gender as a way to kind of also attack people. So I think that trend is interesting, but also comes with its consequences. I'm looking forward to see what will happen. I think in the past history, we haven't seen yet 30% state legislative female representation in state legislative assemblies. Interestingly, Terengganu, I think, has not had any.
Yes, you're right. I think they've had a special seat.
Yeah. So I think it'll be interesting to see that this trend take off.
Arina, I like that you mentioned the intersectionality between gender and age, because it's almost like a double burden if you're young and a woman. Are there ways that we can, as voters, as the media, as the public, as concerned citizens, think about this? Because just before talking to you, I saw a campaign poster in which there were a slew of young candidates, but their ages were printed under that. And I'm curious to know, should we be paying attention to the age of a candidate in this campaign period?
I think it's interesting. I think the age has become a bigger part because of the competition that has come up. I think it's a lot of saturation. So people are trying to find differentiating factors. So age has definitely come up. Even though historically we also had young candidates. I mean, former Prime Minister Najib was 23, you know, when he first entered into politics seriously, but no one really kind of made that comparison. Prabhakaran also in his early 20s. So I think now as more and more candidates come up, I think that's going to be a point. I think people can consider that, but I think ultimately it is about what you prioritize, right? It's about, you know, having a fresh face. Is it about experience? Because just because someone's young doesn't negate the fact that, you know, they could do a good job. So, and politics has a very high barrier to entry. So the fact that they're willing to go and put their names out there at a very young age and risk a lot of things like, you know, their future careers, you know, and financial stability, I think says a lot about their determination to kind of want to change things.
Well, coming back to the 30% representation, women's representation in politics, that I think a few political parties had baked that into their constitution or put that as a guideline in their constitution. It doesn't seem to have made much of an impact in the numbers that we see represented on a nomination day. I'm wondering, because if we break down how candidates are chosen, it's almost always at the discretion of the party president. In GE15, I think Zaid Hamidi said there were some men who didn't want to make way for female counterparts to contest. How do we think about this aspect of political culture? It seems that this is one of the biggest hurdle in increasing not just the representation of women within the party, but also in that final hurdle, that final leap to be fielded as a candidate.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think structures, party structures definitely have to change. I think you can't just relegate them to just a women's wing. I think interestingly, maybe that could also be why Muda fielded so many. It was a very conscious effort. They don't really have a women's wing, but they've made a conscious effort to try and pull more female candidates in. I think also there needs to be an honest conversation in terms of what is this a priority for the party? Because even though you can put it in your manifesto, but, you know, like you said, if you're being selected by the president, like how much of a priority is it? So is it just going to be, you know, all talk? So I think I think this also means then if you're looking at certain party structures, the women then, if you look at, you know, UMNO, they have to be the Ketua Bahagians. Right. Typically, they're the ones that have to have money, power, then only, you know, then you can kind of see, okay, then maybe you can be a candidate or have some sort of standing. So it's very systemic and really starts from the bottom up. You know, so a lot of these women have to start from scratch. You know, I have to have money, I have to have influence. And if you don't have that, then it's going to be really tough to kind of move up.
Okay. And what do you think, is there a role for voters when it comes to addressing the gender parity? You listed the abysmal numbers of of each of the coalitions. Will voters punish parties and coalitions for reneging on promises for gender equality in their lineup?
I think very few would do that, because ultimately when you are, you know, fighting for, you know, when you're looking at priorities and then the priorities have to compete with each other, obviously bread and butter issues will come up. So things like, you know, the economy, what are you going to do for my constituency? How am I going to live in my community? So sometimes gender parity comes a bit lower or is deprioritized when you're putting it against bigger issues. So I think very few would want to punish, candidates or punish parties for, I believe so at this juncture. And they're also probably not willing to take that risk. When you're looking, especially if you're looking at incumbents, you know, am I willing to, especially if they're new, right? So I think it's also a big risk.
Right. And how might the media's portrayal, so I'm just speaking from someone within the media space, but also for those who consume the media, what should we be mindful of, cognizant of, in the way women in politics in this elections are being covered, represented on screen and on our in the reports?
Yeah, I think one is, number one, I think infantilizing some of these women. So, you know, sometimes when they say this young girl, this, you know, so I think some of these terminologies, like, I think we need to be very cautious of how we address, you know, some of these candidates. They are adults, they're all adults. So I think we should all treat them the same. Second is, I think, going into their personal lives or personal choices. So I think, you know, if you're a Muslim, you know, the thing that comes to mind is your headscarf, your awrat, you know, but that doesn't really get covered, you know, in comparison to the men, things like their personal relationships. You know, I think that gets a lot more scrutiny if you're, you know, a woman in comparison to if you're a man. Not to say men don't get it, but I think the tendency is a lot higher. So I think we need to be careful in terms of what angles are we really trying to focus on, especially in the media. What are their competencies? What are their aspirations? And less of the more personal attacks.
All right, something to be mindful of going into the campaign period. Arina, thank you for being on the show today. That's political analyst Arina Najwa Ahmad Syed wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.